it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
We are now joined by Emory McClendon, National Center for Public Policy Research. And Emory happened to be in the rotunda, in the gallery in the rotunda, when they called for a moment of silence for Charlie Kirk in D.C., and he joins us. Emory, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello. Good morning, and thank you for having me on, and good morning to all the people listening on the radio.
So, Emory, your thoughts, thankfully, after 33 hours of incredible police work and the like, putting pressure and the community stepping up in Utah in a big way, which is key, we now have the perpetrator in hand.
Oh, my thoughts are of great joy because we need to get to the bottom of this. We need to have a trial, speedy trial. We need to come to a closure on this because Charlie Kirk was an important figure in the conservative movement and in America, period. And the things that he's done has paved the way, or he was trying to pave the way for unity and for to open up people's minds to believe the truth. So by them stepping up to the plate, giving tips, and the police being able to make this arrest, it's going to bring closure to this, and I think most American people will, it'll ease their tensions and start America back on maybe a healing process that we will see that the government will go ahead and prosecute this case and come to some kind of a conclusion that will be just.
Emory, you know, I've been getting a lot of texts, not a lot, but some texts saying, you know, that Charlie was a racist, he was a fascist, he was this, he was that. It seemed to me, I watched him, I was always intrigued, and I've been watching him for probably 10 years now. I loved the way that he was able to synthesize material, debate the topic, point out the obvious, and it was amazing how many times pointing out the obvious got people tied up like a pretzel, and they didn't know how to deal with that. But it never crossed my mind that he was a racist, a xenophobe, a misogynist, or otherwise. He had his beliefs. He firmly believed in his beliefs. He held true to his beliefs. He lived his life according to his beliefs. So he was not a contradiction in my view. Your thoughts?
That is absolutely true, and that's why I admired him also. I have spoken on several programs and been on several events and conventions and with Charlie Kirk. I can't remember because at the time when I first met him, he wasn't really a big public figure. So my mind can't go back that far because it was years ago, way back even during the first Tea Party events that were taking place around the country. And I was going around doing speeches and being with Americans for Prosperity, the Heritage Foundation. I was with Tea Party Patriots. And I did a lot of programs and forums with them. And he was there. And I do have some photos and everything of him being there on the same program with me. He never came across to me as being that. What he was a great intellectual mind. He sort of reminded me of some of the great theologians back in the day who were able to hear people make complaints or hear people ask questions and then able to bring back a response in a very gentle way, but responses that also would make them think and, like you said, tie them up in knots like pretzels.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he did use very terse, descriptive language, right? I mean, especially in the context of DEI and some of the programs and policies that were put in place as a result of DEI, and some people took offense with that, but I don't ever think that he did it in a way to try to demean. It was more so to make the point that, you know, merit matters and meritocracy matters, and it should always matter.
Yes, he would do it in the same way that I would. I was a very early advocate that DEI and woke policies and some of the other alphabet acronyms that they use for some of their programs, like projects where they were trying to change the date of America's founding and so forth, and teach that in school. I said some of the same things that he said about those programs, and I helped with different groups when they formed their playbooks for why they were against DEI. And being a black person, a lot of people didn't understand that, and especially in my community. But I explained to them, we don't need to progress people and to hire people and to put people in positions that are not qualified. What we need is people who are able to think, who are able to do personal, take personal responsibility and earn what it is that they deserve and the positions that they deserve to be in, because we don't need a people in jobs that are doing things they don't know what they're doing, and they continue and they make things worse than what it is and degrade our society and bring the standards down. And he said some of the exact same things that I said, and I agree with that totally 100%.
Now, my takeaway, you tell me, you're a black conservative. My takeaway, though, was that he was defending black America. Because he knew what human nature was and what the ultimate reaction was going to be, you know, the bigotry of low expectations, right? I mean, you know, and that it was going to be very, very difficult to overcome.
That's exactly correct, because you don't overlook things and give people positions based on their color, based on them not just putting people in positions to make numbers. He was trying to make black people and everyone else in America think about what it is, what tools do I need to succeed in life. He was trying to get them to understand that you just don't want things handed to you on a silver platter and then make a fool out of yourself and end up either losing your job or being in a position that you have no idea how to operate, and then you make it harder for other people of your color or your creed or your race, you know, to get into these positions because you've made such a debacle of it. So you're absolutely correct. I think that those things are important. We need to follow the Declaration of Independence that says that, and the Constitution and all the other important documents and phrases that we've heard, that personality, your efforts, and that we are to pursue happiness and to pursue the American dream in a personal manner and achieve the positions that we want to achieve and be proud of what we've done, not because we've been given those positions.
I'm going to say this. Don't take this the wrong way. I'm sure it's been easier for Charlie Kirk to articulate these positions than for you. If you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, what have you had to face?
I've faced some discrimination in my life, but I didn't take that in a very, very demeaning manner. What I did was try harder to do what I wanted to do. I'll give you one example. I was an Indiana State Trooper. I put in my first application, and as soon as I left, they threw it in the trash. I never heard anything from the personnel office, so I decided to check on it. So I went out to the state police post, and I said, hey, I put in an application for this recruiting class. Recruiting class has started. What happened? I never heard a thing. The lieutenant at the station, at the post, state police post, told me, as soon as you left, he said, I threw it out in the trash can. He said, we didn't want no blacks at this post, or we don't really allow blacks on the state police. And that was true. They didn't have a very few blacks in the state of Indiana on the state police. So I put in a second application. The same thing happened. I put in a third application, but this time what I did was I hand carried the application myself, turned it in, went through the processes, and then I got hired because I had more experience. Prior to being an Indiana State Trooper, I was an Allen County Sheriff Deputy, and I also had about 4.5 years in security, and I'd also been in the military. So I made it through the process. I didn't get passed through. I went through the physical agenda. I went through the mental agenda, passed all the tests. I got 100% on the written test, and I passed the physical, passed the lie detector test, and I became a state trooper.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I did not know that about you. I don't know if you know my history. I was 40 years in law enforcement and 10 years as an elected sheriff down here in the suburbs of New Orleans. So I want to thank you for your service to the community and appreciate that and apologize for that experience, quite frankly.
Thank you. Should
never have been done. What year was that?
It was in 1986, 87, 88. When all that took place. And then I went
in in the aftermath of that, were you able to change that mindset in that organization?
Yes. I sat on some boards and meetings with the superintendent and different other ones in the state police. And we had formed a committee. I worked with the community, and we were able to change that. There was a lawsuit filed. And in the next class after mine, there was an increased number of black applicants that went through and got hired. And even in my class, because I had raised the stink, even, you know, when I turned in that other last application. And we had, I forgot how many it was, but a larger number of blacks in that class, and all of us made it through.
And Emery, do people question you as to being a conservative today in light of that experience?
Yes, especially my family. They couldn't understand how were you treated so badly, but yet you still have the views that you have. Well, my answer to that is I don't value my views on how I'm treated. I don't value my views on how some people treat me, and those are the minority. It's not everybody in America is not prejudiced. Matter of fact, it's a very minute minority of people who are prejudiced and who still hold racial animosity. So I can't let that bother me, because there's so many more people that are willing to do good. So it doesn't affect me. But yes, black community, the first thing they say when you pull up in a police car is you're a traitor and that you are crazy for doing what you do. And I would never do that, because that turns you into an Uncle Tom, quote unquote.
Yeah, that term always, you know, it's amazing to me that they're not able to look at you and others and all of us, quite frankly, through the lens of being an individual, separate and apart from whatever our gender may be, our race may be, sexual proclivity, whatever it may be. I've never really defined people by any of those characteristics.
Me either. And I don't take it out on everyone simply because one person made a statement or one person did something to me, because I realize that doesn't reflect the opinion of all people in America. And so therefore, like I said, I do what I do, and I'm very proud of what I do. I've been involved in the conservative movement ever since I was about 16, 17 years old. It has taken me into places I never have been in my life had I just sat back and been silent. I have seen President Reagan, President George Bush II, and I've been to the White House with President Trump twice. So, and I've been sat in numerous meetings and conferences and so forth at Congress, congressional offices, you name it, Heritage Foundation, Tea Party Patriots, all over the country. And I'm proud to do so. And that was a result of what happened this week when I went to Congress. I was going to visit my congressmen and my senators, both senators from Indiana, and I ended up with some setbacks because of rain and because of plane delays. And I ended up, because I was there late on September the 10th, be able to personally be walked over to the Capitol Gallery by my congressman, who I've known for many years and have helped him, and got to see firsthand experience the ruckus in the congressional floor, on the congressional floor.
Describe that for us, because what you see on TV, I know, is maybe just a snippet of what actually happened, but it didn't seem pretty. I mean, it just didn't sound pretty.
Yeah, it was a lot uglier than what you'll ever see on television, because they're not going to show us. The mainstream media is not going to show us. You can see the blips in the videos when you watch those on YouTube and so forth. I noticed this is not my first time being in the gallery. I think it's my third. And there's three cameras that I recognize that are in there, and they usually flash them back and forth and so forth. Where I was seated, I was just to the right above the head of Nancy Pelosi, AOC, what's her name, Jay. I was to the left of, to the right, just a little bit to the right of, what's her name from Texas?
The
big mouth.
I was having a senior moment.
Yeah, and there was a congresswoman.
Jasmine Crockett.
Yeah, Jasmine Crockett. Presley, I saw, what's his name, Hakeem Jeffries and all that. They were acting like idiots. I mean, after the speaker slapped the gavel down and said, we want to have a few moments of prayer. And then when Congresswoman, Bobit or whatever her name is, anyway, she got up and said, well, why have it silent? We would like to have an audio prayer. And, oh, my goodness, when she said that, some of the black congressional caucus got up, turned their backs on the speaker, got their cell phones out and started texting each other. And then they yelled and they screamed, and then they were yelling at her. I think that the congresswoman that made the statement that she wanted an audible prayer. They told her if it wasn't for, explicit languages when they mentioned God, when she mentioned, well, why not? Let's, you know, pray to God. You could barely hear a lot of it, but because I was there live, I could hear it more plainly than on the videos, but there was explicit language used. There were things said toward each other. You know, they were almost to the point where I thought they were going to start throwing stuff at each other because they started running toward or walking toward each other in a violent way. And then finally, they escorted, one of the congresswomen on the Republican side out the door. And then the speaker kept, slamming his gavel down on the desk, and then pretty soon it all quelled down. But it was a lot worse, believe me, than it was on television, and it was appalling to me. It was very appalling to me because I loved Charlie Kirk, and I also think that our Congress people that represent us in the city of Washington, D.C., should have better manners, should have better actions, and that they set an example for us. And for us to see something, especially for me to see something live and in person like that, you know, if I'd seen it on TV, I probably wouldn't have taken it as seriously. But to see it actually live in person, I just couldn't believe that our people in Congress would act like that.
You know, the interesting thing is that these same people moments before that were saying that this is a time for healing. We have to come together. We have to be bipartisan. You know, and I know you probably believe like I believe, especially coming from law enforcement, actions speak louder than words. And
absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, that's an easy opportunity to compromise, right?
And that's what bothers me. And that's what bothers me, too, is like they always say that kind of stuff, but just buzzwords or cold words to get us to calm down. Because the only thing that seems to motivate a Democrat, or especially the radical Democrats, the people like the Squad, the Congressional Black Caucus and so forth, and those that are more radical in Congress, is to have us acquiesce to their demands, but they never want to compromise with us and our demands. To them, compromise means we surrender.
Yeah. It's interesting. Thank you so much for joining us, Emery McClendon. I've actually seen a number of your interviews, and I really enjoy a number of the writings from the National Center for Public Policy Research and the work that y'all do. And thank you for taking time out today to describe this experience at the Capitol. And have a blessed weekend.
You too. God bless.
Emery McClendon, National Center for Public Policy Research. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
why it's
outside
not,
of Cleveland. Think of the Browns outside of Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.